From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We've got a parade of talent this week. Members of the Grammy-winning Rebirth Brass Band are with us, as are members of the Grammy-winning Preservation Hall Jazz Band. We've got blues belter Mashiya Lake and singer-songwriter Luke Winslow King. And that's just for starters. Highlights from recent episodes of Music Inside Out also include guests who look at music from the outside in. So don't let this parade pass you by. We've got more highlights than a Hollywood hair salon after the break. This week on Music Inside Out, we're playing highlights from recent shows. First up is an excerpt from our talk with Philip Frazier and Gregory Veals of the Rebirth Brass Band. Rebirth has been a game changer in New Orleans brass band music, a tradition that has circled the planet since the early 20th century. Beginning in the 1980s, Rebirth played traditional music, gospel, R&B, and threw in hip-hop as well, challenging every other band on the streets of the city to match its technique. Rebirth set a new standard even for funk music. Consider its version of the James Brown classic, Talkin' Loud and Sayin' Nothin'. This is how the original begins.
Like a gun knife, just ain't cutting. Just talking loud and saying nothing. Just saying nothing. Just saying nothing. You can't tell me how to run my life down. You can't tell me how to keep my business sound. You can't tell me what I'm doing wrong.
Perfectly reasonable. But Derek Tabb, who plays snare drum for Rebirth, created a 15-stroke roll specifically for the beginning of the song. So here's Talkin' Loud and Sayin' Nothin', Rebirth style. That monster roll is rooted in Tab's background in middle school marching band. It now sets the standard for nearly every snare drum player in town. Rebirth's recording of Talkin' Loud and Sayin' Nothin' comes to us from musicologist Matt Sacchini. So next time you hear a 15-stroke drum roll in a New Orleans brass band, thank Rebirth. Rebirth holds down the longest-running gig in New Orleans, more than 20 years of Tuesdays at the famed Maple Leaf Bar. Of course, there have been a few interruptions. Hurricane Katrina, for one, scattered the band for what seemed like forever, and co-founder Keith Frazier has since lived in Texas. In 2008, Philip Frazier had a stroke, which kept him off the bandstand for several weeks.
Woke up, time to get up and say, man, I can't move. Paralyzed. Seriously.
What'd you do?
I fell out of bed. I can't move.
Gee.
They brought me back to the hospital. And I stood in there for about a month, like December 15, since like January 15. Hey, that was a scary moment of my life.
You were in the hospital for a month.
Yeah.
How has your playing changed?
Oh, I think it sounds even better now.
Really?
Really.
Well, every now and then I get a tie.
And who wouldn't? A sousaphone weighs 28 pounds. The average parade in New Orleans is a four-hour trek. That takes a toll on anybody, including Philip Frazier, who loves the sousaphone so much that he slept with it as a child. And when he had the stroke in 2008, he took it with him to the hospital. So in the fall of 2014, after 30 years on the street, Rebirth will retire from the parade route.
I did my time. It's time for younger bands to get on the street now.
Okay.
Passed on to younger generation.
Yeah, 30 years 30 on the street.
No band on the street for 30 years. Consistent. That's true. That's a miracle.
That is a miracle.
Right.
Wow. And so other than your swan song on the parade route, what are you looking forward to as Rebirth?
Well, try to get rich, but let's keep playing music and make everybody happy. Keep it like that. Keep focused on that. Everything else fall over. And please.
Yeah. But you all have so many members. How can a band with so many members get rich?
It can happen. You got to have faith.
Okay. Do you sing at all, Mr. Veals?
I do a lot of screaming.
You do very good. You do very good.
And where may we hear your screaming at its best?
On the next CD, I'll probably do a little screaming and hollering for you.
He wrote a beautiful song.
Really?
Oh, man, it's a masterpiece. He bad one.
Like a bad meaning, like funky bad?
Bad,
or
funky meaning bad.
Really?
Yeah. Bad.
All right, well, I wish you riches and Grammys in your future and good health.
Right.
So Phil Frazier and Gregory Veals, I would like to thank you so much for joining us here at Music Inside Out. You've been dolls.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
What would you like us to end on? What song would you like people to remember?
Oh, Abe Turo.
Rebirth Brass Band playing AP Turo, a tune written by Trombone Shorty. We talked with the band's co-founder, Philip Frazier, and its newest member, trombonist Gregory Veals. Scott Agis has had a long career on the business side of music. He says that a band needs more than one revenue stream to break even, much less get rich. Aegis managed bands for years and now teaches a course in the music business at Tulane University in New Orleans. He also heads programming and marketing at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation. We should mention that Music Inside Out is supported in part by a grant from the foundation. Now, when Aegis talked to us about the music business, he said the money is, has always been, and will likely always be in songwriting.
If you think of a song that's been recorded by many different artists.
Okay.
That helps to clarify a little bit. A classic example is a song like Crazy.
Oh, the great Willie Nelson written song, but made famous by Patsy Cline.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, and you know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So, Willie Nelson writes the song.
Yes.
Patsy Cline sings the song on a record, which becomes a big hit. presumably Patsy Cline may have made some money because the record sold a lot.
Yes.
But that was she was just getting a percentage of the net sales of those pieces of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
Willie Nelson was getting paid because his song was on that record. And so every time somebody else sings that song and puts it on a record, Willie Nelson is the guy that's getting paid for all that.
Crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling so blue. As long as you want it, and then suddenly you leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I let myself worry? In the world did I do?
Crazy, thinking my love holds you. Oh, I'm crazy for trying, crazy for crying, crazy for love.
Of course, the great Patsy Cline singing perhaps the best version of the song, Crazy. Before that, we heard from The Apartment, Chaka Khan, Julio Iglesias, Leanne Rimes, and the song's composer, Willie Nelson. As the artist who made the song a hit, Patsy Cline got the glory. But our guest Scott Aegis says every version of that song represents an income stream for Willie Nelson.
What Willie is making is called the mechanical royalty. That's for
right.
the songwriter. And if the record sells, what Patsy Cline is making is what's called the artist royalty,
the
which
artist
is a percentage
royalty.
Of the net sales revenue from the record.
But then Patsy Cline likely does not own the master.
Correct. Her record company does.
So the record company is making money from the master.
Correct.
Well,
that what they're making in that particular case mm-hmm. is if Patsy, as the artist, is getting a percentage of net sales, the record company's making the rest. So, and then if there comes another use for that recording, like getting it into a movie,
yes.
it's whoever owns the master and whoever owns the underlying composition. Those are the people getting paid. The singer is left out totally.
Wow. Now I can understand why artists become so bitter over the years about
yeah.
money that they never made.
But, yeah, and I mean, nobody said anybody was going to had a right to get rich on this stuff.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, it's a crapshoot.
You can hear more from Scott Aegis and the other guests featured this week on our website at musicinsideout.org. Still to come, a voice refined by the chewing up and swallowing of glass. Stay with us. It's Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Mashiya Lake is something of an enigma. She's tiny, tiny, but has a big, big voice. Before singing full-time, Lake was a circus performer. Eating glass and fire dancing only made her singing more interesting. She's thoroughly modern, yet her music takes you back to the brothels of Storyville, or post-any war Europe, or the juke joints of the Mississippi Delta.
When it rained 5 days and the sky turned black as night, oh, when it rained 5 days, the sky turned black as night. Trouble's going on in the lowlands late at night. Now when it thunders and lightning and that wind begin to blow, when it thunders and it lightning and that wind begin to blow, oh, thousands of people, they ain't got nowhere to go. Things and go. Oh, backwater blues caused me to pack my things and go. There ain't no place for this poor old girl to go.
Excellent. You have self-confidence, Miss Schielig.
I have no choice.
I like that a lot. So I call you a chanteuse, which suggests that you're fetching, you've got a great pair of lungs, and you create something magical that happens when you step on stage. But that word doesn't necessarily cover all that you can do because you sing so many different kinds of music. This all began in Oregon?
Well, I guess so, because that's where I was born. But the music began in South Dakota.
South Dakota.
Because that's where we were living when I was nine, when I began. My parents had divorced, and my mama was going out looking for a new husband and would take me and my sister along to this place called the Elk Creek Steakhouse and Lounge that housed the South Dakota Opry. And they had a singing contest one night. It was all grown-ups and very, very sincere, you know. They were very serious about it. And so they thought it was really cute when I was like, well, I want to be in the singing contest. I've had three Shirley Temples. I'm ready to go. And I got up and sang Walking After Midnight by Patsy Cline. And, well, they were quite surprised about the sound that came out of this little tiny redheaded girl. So I won the contest. I won $500.
Not bad.
Yeah. And then they gave me a job. And I sang two songs every Saturday night, and I got paid $25 a song.
Well, okay, you know, truth be told, you're still a little redheaded girl, okay? So
yeah, I haven't grown much since then.
I don't think you have, right? But you know, we're going to have to ask you if you can sing a little bit of the song for us, Walking After Midnight.
Oh, sure. I have to do a cappella, though.
That's fine.
That's right. I go out walking after midnight, out in the starlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you. I walk for miles out on the highway. That's just my way of saying I love you. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you. Is that good enough, or you want me to go to the bridge? I could do the bridge.
Do the bridge!
I stop to see a weeping willow crying on his pillow. Maybe he's crying for me. And as the skies turn gloomy, night winds whisper to me, I'm lonesome as I can be. walking after midnight out in the starlight, just hoping that you'll be somewhere out walking after midnight, searching for me. That was the slide at the end.
Not bad. That is fantastic. You know, there's a recording, actually, of Patsy Cline just after she'd recovered from a terrible car accident. I don't know if you ever heard that recording, because no. I know that you have just been recovering from a terrible bicycle accident.
That is correct.
You know, a lot of folks have been asking, well, what happened to you? You look kind of beat up. No, seriously, another woman tried to pass another car in front of my brother and I and hit us head on. And this happened about June the 14th, and it broke my hip, dislocated it, and broke my right arm and cut my face up a little bit. And in 3 months, I'll go back for more plastic surgery, and then they say they're going to give me a facelift and it's going to make me like new. And until then, I'm so glad to be back. Thank you. I fall to pieces each time I see you again.
I bet she needed to sing so bad after that.
Do you really need to sing?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. It's a need. It's a soulful need to do it. You know, it's some things inside that I have to get out, you know? Like, it wells up too much if I don't. It's like there's this little steam button or something on my head, and if I don't press the steam button, that it builds up too much, you know? Like, after the bike accident, I went and did a gig the next day.
Are you serious?
And it felt so good to sing. It hurt, you know, because my head's hurt. Like, there was pressure, but a couple of Advils and a beer, and I was fine, and I got to sing Etta James, I'd Rather Go Blind, with the rock and roll band, and it felt incredible. Like, it's healing. It's part of the healing process. And while medical professionals may say that you need to stay home and rest, and they're probably right, but your soul needs things to heal yourself as well.
That's Mashiya Lake. To hear more from her and all of our guests this week, visit our website at musicinsideout.org. You'll find all of our shows archived and ready for streaming online. New Orleans people, of course, are aware their jazz heritage is disappearing, and some are trying somehow to save the only art form that is strictly, entirely American. One effort to save it is here at Preservation Hall. An art dealer named Larry Borenstein furnished the hall, and a young couple named Alan and Sandra Jaffe started this. The one and only David Brinkley, from an NBC News report back in 1961. Preservation Hall is still a haven for traditional jazz, and it's still a family affair. Alan and Sandra Jaffe's son, Ben, is the music director. For the first time in Preservation Hall history, the band has released an album of new and original music. Take a listen to the title track, That's It, written by Ben Jaffe. It's exuberant. Ben, you wrote this song.
Yes.
And it's as if you had something that you really needed to get off your chest. I mean, what do you hear when you hear that song?
I wanted it to sound like an elephant running through the French Quarter.
We'll be right back.
we've got Mark Bro.
Oh, he's perfect.
Yeah, is on trumpet. Yeah. You know, two of his uncles have led the Preservation Hall band, Wendell Brunius, the great Wendell Brunius, and the late great John Brunius. And Mark is, you know, took over John's chair. That's a Freddie Lonzo on the trombone. You know, I've known him. You know, he played with my dad when he was 16 in the Olympia Brass Band. You know, and that's Joe Lasty Jr. from the great Lasty family, and that's Clint Majan on the saxophone. A lot of people know Clint from the New Orleans Bingo Show.
Yes,
and that's Ronnell Johnson on the tuba.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to move into that song. I just want to move in and pay rent and stay there for the rest of my life.
It's something else, isn't it?
Clarinetist Charlie Gabriel has joined us. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure is mine, honey.
Well, Charlie, you know what? Show me that the melody on the Yellow Moon.
Fantastic. That's Charlie Gabriel on clarinet and Ben Jaffe on bass at Preservation Hall in the French Quarter. Still to come, what do beasts sound like in the Southern Wild? Stay with us. It's Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and we're playing highlights from recent shows. When singer-songwriter Luke Winslow King spoke with us, we accused him of being too perfect. And what did he do? He gave us a perfect performance, the last of many in that hour.
I have this new traveling song that I'm really excited about. I think it's going to come out on the next album. I wrote this on a train in Italy like 5 or 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and then pretty much threw it in the trash and never liked it. And then I found this groove that I really liked for it, and I've been kind of reviving it. And I'd love to share it with you. It's called Traveling Myself.
Traveling all by myself, wanna be nobody, babe, wanna be myself when I go traveling. Traveling by myself, yeah. I can't love you, baby, less I'm being myself. guess I'm being myself. Ain't a pay no ticket, ain't a pay no fee, ain't a work for no man. I get it all for free when I go out traveling. I can't love nobody less I'm being myself. Singing, howling in your square. If you like my song, Rapunzel, won't you let me down your hair when I go traveling? Oh, traveling by myself. I can't love you, honey, less I'm being myself. When I go traveling all by myself, wanna be nobody, baby, I just wanna be myself when I go. Less I'm being
there. All right. That was Luke Winslow King with Traveling Myself. Our final excerpt focuses on music in the movies. When we talked to NPR film critic Bob Mondello, he reminded us that there's always been music at the movies, even when the pictures were silent. The song Smile, for instance, was written by Charlie Chaplin for the silent film Modern Times.
Are we as moviegoers expected to understand that the music that we're listening to is somehow a reflection of the character who is on screen?
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, if a musician, a composer who's designing a score for a film is going to create a theme for a character. That's true in Star Wars, it's true in everything else, that when Princess Leia walks on screen, there's a theme that follows her, and it follows her through the music and through the movie, and yes, it's essential, and it does tell you kind of what she's thinking at any given moment, or at least underscores what she's thinking, so that if she's getting excited, you might expect the tempo to pick up a little bit. And if she's it's a romantic moment, then everything will be calm and maybe kind of lush. So, yeah, it tells you a lot about what the person's thinking.
Well, what are some of your favorite, you know, musical moments in film? I mean, you watch, what, 300 pictures a year?
Roughly, yeah. It's a few fewer than that, thank heaven. But yes, well, a lot of things come to mind. I mean, in Apocalypse Now, there is that bum ba da bum 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 ba da bum bum, which is accompanies the helicopters, which is like just absolutely pins that moment. One use of music that I thought was really fascinating. Kenneth Branagh did a movie of Henry V. You remember?
Oh, yes, I remember very well.
And he was, a lot of people said at the time that he was doing the same kind of thing that Laurence Olivier had done.
Who had played Henry V and directed the film.
In the films. And yes. It was a very different way of doing it back then because he was using Henry V to be all about World War II and about the entrance into war. And Kenneth Branagh was using the battle scenes in Henry V to talk about how terrible war was and devastating. This is the speech that Henry V gives to his troops on the eve of battle. He is about to lead them into this huge charge. They are so outnumbered by the French, and he is taking them into battle, and he tells them that they should be proud to be there. Well, Laurence Olivier did it without music.
Yes.
And he let the power of his voice carry him.
Let's listen.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so base. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Now, that was perfectly powerful in 1942, but when Kenneth Branagh did it, he decided to goose it up a little bit.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Oh, my God, right? I mean,
it's
you'd follow
fabulous.
This guy anywhere.
You
it's
totally
amazing.
Would. And, I mean, I think that, to be honest with you, I think that everybody should listen to this speech on Monday morning before you roll out of bed. It will inspire
well, that would
you
work. Yes.
To
that,
get
that will get
off
you
your
started.
Duff. Exactly, absolutely. And go to work or go to school or do whatever you're supposed to do because it really does rouse the troops. Now, here in Louisiana, obviously, there have been quite a few films that have been set here. One of my favorites, which is, of course, A Streetcar Named Desire. That's the Elia Kazan film. Has a perfect cast, perfect director, perfect everything.
Blanche and Stanley.
Yeah.
Blanche Dubois, who comes to New Orleans sort of down on her heels. She's her life has gone wrong. She is filled with dreams that are not coming true, and she meets the husband of her sister, who is a brute. And she is delicate and flighty, and he is a brute. They have a clash. It's quite a clash.
It really is. And as you say, I mean, the Blanche Dubois character is extremely delicate. And so music seems to follow her wherever she goes. And in these scenes in which she's actually interacting with Stanley Kowalski, played by, of course, Marlon Brando, you get the feeling that she's trying to keep the music in the scene and he's trying to take it out.
You must be Stanley. I'm Blanche.
Oh, you're still sister.
Yes.
Oh, hi. Yeah, where's the little woman?
In the bathroom.
Oh. Well, where are you from, Blanche?
Well, I live in Oriel.
Oriel. Oriel, huh? Oh, yeah, that's right. Oriel, that's not my territory. Man, look, it goes fast in the hot weather. You want a shot?
No, I rarely touch it.
Well, there's some people that rarely touch it, but it touches them often.
A Streetcar Named Desire is purportedly the first major motion picture that features an entirely jazz score. You know, that was written by Alex North, who was, in fact, a big Duke Ellington fan.
This is a wonderful score. You can hear the difference in the two of them, the thumping thing that they're doing for him and that sultry thing that they're doing for her.
Exactly.
And it is really compelling. And this is an example of having themes for characters and things like that. They're not connecting, right? It doesn't feel like it's coming together.
But there's also a very seductive aspect to this, you know, to the sound, in the sense that, you know, I guess Blanche is trying to weave her magic, but at the same time, Stanley is trying to seduce her in some kind of way.
Marlon Brando walked on that screen and seduced everybody. It wasn't just Blanche. And, you know, this was his first big picture. It was the first time we'd seen him, and he comes in and takes off his shirt, and oh, my God, you know? So that everybody was sort of reacting to him as a gorgeous animal up there on screen, right?
Exactly.
And in choosing to do a picture in the 1950s, that was black and white, you're making a statement of sorts that you want this to be gritty and real.
That's
right. And the music is pulling you into a different place.
Thanks so much, Bob. It's been a thrill.
It's great to be with you again. This is terrific.
NPR's movie critic Bob Mondello speaking to us from Washington.
I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. If movie music tells us who's who on screen and where the action is taking place, then what do you make of this original song? Of the Southern Wild turns on the story of a little girl called Hush Puppy, who lives in the southernmost reaches of Louisiana, which is to say, surrounded by water and quickly losing ground. Hush Puppy lives with her dad, but the absence of her mother from their lives is a matter of hurt, ambiguity, and longing. Dan Romer and Ben Zeitlin found a way to communicate this musically with original composition and a song from Tin Pan Alley. Director Ben Zeitlin joins us here at Elephant Quilt Studios in New Orleans. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
What is your background in music?
I don't really have a formal background in music. My friends asked me when I was in seventh grade if I would join their band because they thought I was the one who could scream the loudest.
Can you?
At that time, I was going through puberty, so I had a real high, shrill shriek that they thought was perfect for the kind of, Nirvana derivation they were after. So I basically started singing in that band. I taught myself how to play guitar. I started writing songs for that band. And that was like my entire life through high school. And basically, you know, writing for when I started getting more interested in movies, I didn't want to stop writing music. And I kind of transitioned through writing for theater and then eventually started writing music for my own films.
And so where did you grow up? Where were you in seventh grade when you were doing your Nirvana imitation?
I was in a town called Hastings, which is right above New York, which I moved to. I grew up in Queens and then I moved to Hastings and was completely shunned from society. And so this moment where these guys asked me to be in a band was like the first good thing that had happened to me living in this new town. And so it really became a huge part of my life.
Wow, that's interesting. So how good is your shriek today? Can you really shriek?
I can still scream pretty loud.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Can you give us an example? Sold. That's pretty good.
You know, I got training, you know.
What was the name of the band?
The band was called Sorry Porky, and thank God there's absolutely no record of our music that can be found.
Sorry Porky.
Yeah.
Okay, don't look at me when you say that now. Now, the thing is, you wrote for your band, you wrote for theater, and then as you got into films, as you say, you decided you didn't want to give that up as well.
Yeah, no, it was never like I don't think I ever make a whole lot of sort of strategic conscious decisions in general, but it was never sort of thinking, oh, I want to be a composer director.
Right.
You know, it just starts from making short films, and you can't get anybody to help you, so you do it yourself. You know, and everything sort of started like that for me. And then once, and then as it developed, it started becoming hard for me to imagine making a film where I wasn't writing the music. It just became part of the thinking of how it was written and how it was edited, and it just ends up being kind of sewn into the process.
One of the things that I love about your film is that it doesn't overdo music. You know, there is often a tendency in lots of pictures, you know, in which there's so much music that you kind of are distracted from what's happening on the screen. Did you all make any particular decisions about that, the use of music and how much you wanted in the film?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's always a huge sort of battle in your head. And you know, what it comes down to me, it's always about redundancy. You know, the places where you notice that music is too much is when the music is telling you the same thing that the script is telling you, the same thing that the visuals are telling you, and everything is telling you the same thing. And it's like listening to someone repeat themselves, you get like, oh, God, is it
so boring?
Please move on, you know?
Yes.
And so for me, that goes back to the writing process where, you know, an example, you know, is at the beginning of the film when Hush Puppy's running with fireworks in her hands. And, you know, if you take the music out of that, you would think, oh, my God, this girl is going to set herself on fire. This is horrible. I don't want to watch this film. Like, this is a disaster.
This,
you know,
is self-immolation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, in writing it, I knew that, you know, the score is not telling you what's happening. The score is telling you what Hush Puppy thinks is happening. And for her, it's this glorious moment of
magic,
family and tradition and her customs, and everything is beautiful. And so you give it this cinematic, you know, national anthem theme, and you're getting information crossing paths and coming in two different ways and building on itself. And so whenever the music is doing that, I always feel like, you know, you're doing the right thing. One of the things it took us a long time to figure out is that the music is really broadcasting from Hush Puppy's head.
Yes.
In the entire film. And that was real tough because, like, there's lots of places in the film where we wanted to use music, but if Hush Puppy isn't imagining anything or thinking anything, if she's just sort of sitting there, there's no way to put music in. It
right.
really would always feel completely wrong. And so that, figuring out, like, when she starts to drift and when she comes back, was a whole process that we had to do in post to figure out when she's broadcasting and when there's radio silence.
Now, as we mentioned before, I mean, the film tells the story of this young girl, Hush Puppy, and her father, Wink, is his name.
That's it.
And but the absence of the mother in the story, it's filled with all sorts of, you know, hurt and ambiguity and longing. And so you feel the presence of the mother throughout the film.
Yeah.
And all. And so tell us about Mama's Song.
Yeah. No, we needed to give we needed to give her a very different musical texture from the rest of the film.
The mother,
yeah. You know, because of exactly what you're saying, that she had to be this presence that was very palpable, even though she's never around. Personal mythology for the mom, which is that basically all Hush Puppy knows is that she swam away. You know, when you're in South Terrebonne Parish, you know,
which is where we shot the film,
yeah. You know, far away does not mean Japan. Far away means New Orleans. Like, it made sense to me that this far away feeling would be sort of a jazz New Orleans feeling, and very much inspired by the Fats Waller song that we use in the film. That and sort of French jazz chords. Like, we wanted to use a very different chord. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of listened to a lot of Edith Piaf for the Mom and sort of hybridized this sort of, like, tough, elegant feeling that Edith Piaf has with a sort of, like, woozy Fats Waller piano feeling. And sort of that's how that song was born, was kind of giving that very specific feel, like, its own place and never using it unless the Mom was being thought about. And so exactly. Anytime you see her, you feel this one chord that, you know, doesn't exist in the rest of the film.
Filmmaker Ben Zeitlin directed Beasts of the Southern Wild. He and Dan Romer composed the film's original score. And you've been listening to Highlights from Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Jason Ryan, and Sean Collins. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. Be sure to visit our website at musicinsideout.org. And do us a solid. Share our stuff on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Music Inside Out is underwritten by the Historic New Orleans Collection, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.